received the highest honor, but we'd rather talk about the names of the incestuous family. Forget the hero, Boy Scouts. There's two Boy Scouts won an honor today. But let's talk about the names of all the people that are marrying their daughters.
What? I don't see anything that was newsworthy about them.
Any of that, really.
Marrying her daughter. I mean, stuff like that happens, but why is it national newsworthy?
Nothing else to talk about. It's titillating. You can sound professional and still talk about scandal. Brexit is news. Nations are divorcing. Divorces aren't news, except sometimes they're titillating. Do you know how you titillate an ocelot? Oscillate its tits a lot.
Political joke,
right?
I don't think it would work if an ocelot had big claws.
Ready?
Once more under the breach, dear friends.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and all the children in Radioland. I thought I would throw that in there today. With another example of inanity in action on this, the second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
We haven't talked about something important that's happening right now.
Inanity in action?
That plus some.
What?
The gathering of the Scottish clans,
yes.
The Highland Games are happening,
yes.
Right now, today, tomorrow,
in Salado,
and if you want to see men walking around in skirts, I mean kilts, and playing screeching cats, I mean bagpipes, then you should go. There are Highland dancers, all the way from, looked like maybe a three-year-old girl all the way up to people in their 70s throwing their legs in the air and jumping up and down in a very coordinated manner.
And they catch their legs when they fall. That's what
that's really important.
They throw them up in the air.
Yeah. So that's going on, and people will be throwing big logs and big stones.
And big rocks, yes.
Caber tosses and so on. So it's fun for all. Lots
and there's
of
good food.
Good food.
You like haggis.
Yes. If you like sheep stomach-filled food, which we both do, and I realize people hear us say, sheep stomach, ew, gross. But you eat sausage. If you eat sausage, you've got intestine lining in there. It's good stuff.
It is.
You just got to... It's better that we know what we eat, I think, instead of trying to ignore it. Where does meat come from? Well, it comes from the grocery store,
comes
right?
From dead animals have been probably dead for days or maybe even weeks.
Yeah. Yeah, I prefer to know what it is that I'm eating. Anyway, that's going on this weekend, and dead animals are being eaten as well.
Yes, and there's a lot of music and a lot of places to buy interesting hand-created stuff. We visited last weekend at the Austin version.
The Celtic Festival in Austin, which is a bit smaller.
The rest and the mass.
How often do you get to say that about an Austin festival versus a Salado festival?
Right.
Maybe once a year.
And just going around and seeing the shops where people make and or have made all the artwork and the items that are useful to be used, it's worth it just to go to see the vendors.
Some of the items are only useful at events like the Gathering of the Clans. Like, would you like to buy something to wear with your kilt? Yeah, well, I'm going to wear this a lot. Every year I'll wear it once.
Well,
maybe.
Actually,
maybe.
I've gotten to wear it more than once a year.
Yeah.
Because sometimes I just walk around the house in my skirt kilt.
Yes.
And
my daughter really loves that I wear a kilt occasionally. She's 2 years old, and she thinks that's fantastic that she's wearing a skirt and I'm wearing a kilt. And she definitely knows that a kilt is not a skirt, even if we joke that it is sometimes. It's not that big a difference. It is a piece of cloth that's worn around your waist and rather comfortable on hot days, I would say.
And you can wear really long knives with them in Texas now when you couldn't before.
Right. So that was our long talk about what's going on this weekend. We hope that you all head over to Salado and enjoy it. It's worth it. Love it.
We were going to talk about, oh, by the way, the telephone number in here remains 773-1400, local area, of course, 254.
And this
773-1400, and this is the personal wealth coach. And Jake is going to tell us, he's going to tell about, oh boy, here
we go. We keep getting interrupted by telephone calls.
You're not
going to
get to tell about Venezuela.
All right, caller on 773-1400, you're on the air, go ahead.
All of them of any significance, obviously. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. We the Scots-Irish American people are notorious for a couple of things. Drinking heavily, not drinking at all. The saying, you can have my gun when you take it out of my cold, dead fingers.
Mm-hmm. Don't tread on me, the flag.
Yeah. And generally for hating the British and being willing to fight over almost anything at the drop of a hat.
Yes. Anyone's hat.
Yes. And so, yeah, you're right. Many, many, many of our warriors are soldiers who have gone to war professionally, and to this day, even true, are Scots-Irish.
The first battle that was won against the British in the Revolutionary War was headed up by Colonel John McClure. So, and that is our direct ancestor going back, and George Washington.
I was trying to say, you're a bit prejudiced about saying yes. The first and greatest battle
won. No, it was the first battle won by the Americans. I think that's a pretty good statement.
Obviously, it was the turning point of the war, without which the country would not exist today.
It was.
Thanks to John McClure.
And if you go back, George Washington said as much. He said, if we lose everywhere else, I'm going to go stand with the presbyters. Which is the Presbyterian Church is the Church of Scotland, and the people that left Scotland were Presbyterian mostly. And so the battles that were won after that were, and this is the funny part, the Scottish folks up in the Appalachian Mountains of the Carolinas, when the revolution was being fought, they weren't involved. They didn't care. They had more pressing business. The Indians were attacking. So they had a militia that they could call up very quickly, and they had signals that they could send back and forth, and they knew, and they practiced regularly, and they got, you know, the whole constitutional thing about a well-organized militia was based on this.
Yeah.
It was based on this. We got to defend each other. So the British decided that they would go and draft forcibly, impress. It's very impressive to be impressed. A bunch of these Carolina Scotsmen.
Or barring... able to impress and take their guns away from them.
Yes. So they went up into the hills, a brigade of British dragoons, and these are the most elite of the elite. And they went up to take as many menfolk as they could to get them into the armed service so that they could fight the other Americans. They took the house of John McClure. And John McClure wasn't present at the time, but the call went out and the militia all showed up and surrounded the house. And there was a big... shoot off, and the dragoons were defeated in mass, and that was the first battle of the American Revolutionary that was won by the revolutionaries, because they weren't really revolutionaries at that point. But then they all got together and joined the Revolutionary Army, and
well, I said they didn't join the Revolutionary Army; they just formed their own.
Well, they formed their own and then joined together.
Yeah.
So he was a captain at that point and became a colonel later. So. That's just we appreciate that. We've got a lot of family history in the military going back every generation that we can find. All right, so Venezuela. That's a big segue. It's no segue at all. Just immediate subject change to something we've been wanting to talk about.
Which has next to nothing to do with going to war.
Hopefully.
I don't think it has anything.
Right. The president of Venezuela... Maduro, which sounds almost like a beer brand. It's not. That's Modelo.
Oh.
But Maduro formed a committee this last week, to restructure the debt of Venezuela. I heard some kind of crazy economic discussions about how much work it's going to be to restructure the debt. There's a lot of debt, and it's in a lot of issues. Unlike stocks, bonds can be issued at any given time for any amount of money with a different maturity date for each. It's a separate loan every time it comes out. There are many, many thousands of loans that they're talking about restructuring. Some of them are really, really big, and some of them are really, really small.
Go ahead.
Every one of those loans has someone on the other end of the loan to whom the Venezuelans owe money. To restructure the debt, they have to negotiate with everybody. Everybody that holds a debt to Venezuela needs to be negotiated with, because if it's not agreed upon, then they have the right to sue them in international court. That's part of the way that they were able to get the loans when they got them, was to agree to be subject to the international court and international law on the repayment of debt.
Venezuela recently made a choice to pay to redeem a series of bonds that had matured, over $1 billion worth, that were issued by the oil company of Venezuela.
Citgo.
Well, no, not Citgo.
No, that's just the external face of it.
Citgo is its external retail face. And the reason, according to the Venezuelan finance minister, was that the oil is where they get their revenue, and if the government doesn't restructures its bonds, then they don't have assets overseas that can be seized. But the Venezuelan oil company has Citgo assets, for instance, all over the United States that can't be seized.
Right, and it's listed as collateral.
And, well, not listed as collateral. It's listed as collateral on the oil bonds, but not on their federal bonds, their government bonds.
Right.
However, they didn't do their homework very well, because it is the court. The cases are already being lined up. The lawyers are hired. The briefs are written, and they're ready as soon as Venezuela officially says we're not paying our debt
to go and seize a bunch of assets in the United States and elsewhere for Citgo, as in oil platforms in the Gulf of Mexico and
oil stations and oil
in Texas and Houston oil refineries. Yes.
So it's going to be pretty fascinating to see what happens next. But I think it's probably going to, one of the things is obviously there's a lot of assets whose price is going to be affected by this.
Right, and the committee that was put together is a story in itself. For those of you who haven't been following the news about Venezuela, we have them under a series of sanctions because of their human rights issues over not doing good democratic elections, and that they say they're democratic, but when 99% of the people vote for one person, it kind of loses its credibility.
Well, actually, 99% of the people voted for Maduro, and there was unexpected fatalities among 1% of the voters.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty much the case. So right now there's lack of food. There's lots of problems. The currency in Venezuela is not worth the paper it's printed on.
Literally.
They don't grow enough food in Venezuela to provide for themselves. Even though the country is capable of doing it, they have been living off of the largesse of the price of oil. And the price of oil has dropped drastically. They're now in a lot of debt. They've got a lot more debt than they can afford to even make the payments on a regular basis. This is why last hour we were talking about the sale of oil. But this committee is a story in itself. Two of the people that were appointed by President Maduro to the committee are already listed under sanction by the United States government. One of them is under sanction because of the human rights stuff with Venezuela. The other one has nothing to do with human rights stuff. It's to do with the fact that he's the head of a major drug cartel.
And so we can't negotiate with him.
Right. So when the president of Venezuela knowingly puts two people that financial negotiations are illegal with on a committee to negotiate with people, He's not saying, I want to negotiate. He's giving the excuse in advance for why negotiations will fail.
It's because the United States put sanctions on
them. Yeah, they're making us go into default. It's the United States' fault. Well, this is a smart move by him if he wants good public opinion. I don't think it's going to help him in the world of public opinion, because when people are starving and you're not invading the enemy, you don't gain kudos for saying they did it to us.
I think, from a practical point of view, there's something important. Both Puerto Rico, which is a U.S. territory and is a total basket case as far as finance is concerned, incapable of paying, it would need to restructure its debt before, and it actually was in a form of bankruptcy. Now, there's no way they can touch their debt. And Venezuelan debt and Puerto Rican debt are largely held by hedge funds. Now, there's other organizations that hold them too, and they've been selling them off, bond funds. But there's a day of reckoning coming, and there's the assumption that somehow the U.S. will step in, or they'll be able to seize Citgo assets. There's a series of assumptions that we can make good on this, but they're based on assumptions, and there's nothing more than that. We could see some major hits to hedge funds, with hedge funds closing. Well, there's already been a bunch of hedge funds closed, but hedge funds closing and liquidating at substantial losses on this.
And we saw a hit to the bond market this week as well, specifically in national debts and municipalities. And it had to do with Venezuela and Puerto Rico. It had to do with the same reason why the price of gold fell, to pay for the debts.
And both Puerto Rican bonds and Venezuelan bonds, in many cases, not in many cases, but certainly in some cases, are insured by MBIA or one of the other two major bond insurance companies. And there's a serious question as to whether or not, if Venezuela and Puerto Rico default, those companies will stay in business, which means that if you have a municipal bond and it's AAA rated, but it's AAA rated because it's insured, and the insurance company that insured it defaults, then it's not a AAA bond anymore. And it's not that you'll lose all your money or anything, but if you or your heirs go to sell them on the open market in the future, particularly if interest rates are higher, you could see a very substantial loss.
So a lot of the debt is owned by United States hedge funds and by United States citizens. This meeting that has been called, this is the whole purpose of the committee, was to call a meeting to negotiate the debt. The sanctions we have against specific people, the DEA has sanctions against one of the guys and the State Department has sanctions on the other guy, says that you're not allowed to meet with these people about financial stuff, period. So the head of this committee said, we're going to meet to discuss our debts on November 13th, which they called the meeting yesterday, and the meeting is just a couple of days from now. So Monday, they're having the meeting. They called it on Friday. These are people that have to come from all over the world, and they can't. They can't go to the meeting because they would be meeting with people who are sanctioned. So as I said, this is like the perfect statement. If Maduro really doesn't want to pay the debt, but does want to lay the blame at the feet of the United States and saying we can't pay the debt because the sanctions of the United States will not allow us, rather than the fact that he's been grossly misusing the money of the country for many years and that his predecessor many years before that. So that's the news in Venezuela.
And you're listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. The telephone number in here remains 773-1400. Of course, area code is 254. Let's talk about the tax plan a minute.
Okay.
The Senate has issued a tax plan different, not the Senate, the chairman.
The Finance Committee.
The chairman of the whose name is Hatch.
Orrin. Yes, Orrin Hatch.
Of the Senate Finance Committee has issued a proposal to be marked up which I was told as a kid you're not supposed to mark up things like that.
Oh, they do it all the time, yeah.
Just as the Representative Brady issued a proposal in the House of Representatives, but they didn't just issue these in a vacuum. They discussed this at length with their caucus and with their party members, and they reached a conclusion to what they wanted.
And their chamber members. The Senate talked to the Senate and the House to the House, and right. They didn't talk to each other at all.
But this is the interesting point. They obviously didn't bother talking to each other because...
Or even reading each other's cliff notes.
There's a big difference. For example, the Senate bill has 7 tax brackets. The House bill has 4.
Well, let me say this real quick. We currently have... Technically, 7 tax brackets.
Actually, they're not bills, they're proposals.
Right. They're to the point where they start to become a bill later. Okay, so we currently have 7, just in case people aren't following that. The Senate bill says we keep 7, although one of them drops a percentage point from 39.6 to 38.5.
They drop all of the brackets a little bit.
All right. So, in effect, they also say that businesses will be able to deduct 17.4%, small businesses, 17.4% of their business income.
If they're not a service business.
Well, this one, it doesn't make the differential.
Yeah, I read the bill. I read the proposal.
Okay. Which, in effect, makes 7 new brackets on top of the existing 7 brackets.
So tax simplification changes the tax law to where now we have 14 brackets instead of 7, and they overlap each other.
Yes, and they don't fit together nicely. It makes some kind of combination of each of those, and nobody knows where they fall.
The Senate version does not eliminate the estate tax at any point, or the death tax, as it's called. It does double the exemption, at least temporarily, and this is interesting. The temporary doubling of the exemption expires in 2027, so die quickly. We'll have people rushing to die.
Yes. Fast. Kill me now, quickly.
And they also said, oh, well, it's probably too expensive to actually cut taxes on corporations in 2018, so we'll wait till 2019. The interesting thing about waiting till 2019, we're going to have congressional elections between now and then, so there'll be a different Congress in place at that point. And the different Congress
may or may not agree with this law.
So that's, we got a blip in the stock market this week, primarily because when you calculate the value of the appropriate value of a share, and most shares are appropriately valued right now based on history, when you actually do the numbers, one of the things you factor in is tax expense. And if you factor in that the corporate income tax rate will be 20% instead of 35% or 39% for a corporation, well, obviously it makes their earnings go up and it makes their stock more valuable. And so there was actually a drop of about 1.1% on Thursday in the S&P 500, but we wound up down 0.2%, which means that by the time they looked at it all, they said, yeah, it's earnings that are driving this, and the market is fairly priced based on the increased earnings we've seen. We really haven't priced in a 20% tax cut, so there's really no reason for the market to go down. So we're basically waiting on earnings this week. But there's actually more complexity than this in the Senate bill and in the House bill that are antithetical, that's my word for the day, to each other. Here's the big news from my perspective. The senators who are supporting the Senate bill openly seem to agree that the House bill is unacceptable, totally unacceptable for a host of reasons. The House members who openly support the House bill rather than just passively supporting it agree that the Senate bill is unacceptable, but both of them, off the record, staff members are saying we're short between $75 and $80 billion in revenue or elimination of tax cuts to make this thing hit the $1.5 trillion mark that the budget resolution calls for. So we're either going to have to kill some tax deductions that we've got in the proposal or raise some taxes someplace else, or this thing won't fly. Now, they're officially waiting for the Congressional Budget Office to rate the plan, to actually analyze the plan and come back and say, here is the budgetary result if this passed. before they move forward. But
what we said,
what we're saying is that the tax bills are so far apart, and there's so much deep feeling and animosity built up there. There's a Wall Street is saying there's about a 50-50 chance we won't get any tax reform at all.
Right, and this is something we mentioned in passing last week when we got into some detail about the House version of tax reform. It's really easy to get lost in the little details here and to start locking in all these numbers of this is the way the deductions are going to be on this or that. The reality is we now have two completely different proposals that still have to be negotiated between the two side. This is, they do that in conference where the House and the Senate, after each of them have passed their prospective bills, get together, sit down. The conference committee is made up of members of the House and members of the Senate. They negotiate it back and forth. Then they both have to vote on it again. There can be no amendments or changes.
Both houses have to vote on it again.
Both houses have to vote on it again. So there can be no amendments or changes once it's passed conference. That's the whole thing, the whole concept to avoid the filibuster. They have either that or they have to get a supermajority in the Senate. That's not going to happen.
Get a bunch of Democrats to love this bill.
Right. And that's not going to happen. There's just no way, even if they really did love it, they're still not going to vote for it because politically it's not expedient right now. And people might say, oh, Democrats are trying to throw the health of the country on the floor. Well, the Republicans are doing it too. If they're trying to repeal a law without replacing it, then that's not going to be good. Even if the law they're repealing isn't good, it has a structure in place. You got to have something to replace it. So political expediency is the name of the game right now on either party.
And to give you some history on this, the last time we just made this major of a change in the United States tax law was in 1986. And the president and his Office of Management and Budget.
I would say the last time we made as major a change as the one in the House, you're right. The one in the Senate isn't as major a change.
Right.
It's more like the Bush tax cuts.
But the last time we did a overhaul of the tax code, the way this is at least proposed.
Change the brackets, all that good stuff.
Was in 1986, and we had a very charismatic president who were capable of appealing, and we had the majority leader, who incidentally was a Democrat, of course, Tip O'Neill, in the House of Representatives and in the Senate, in agreement, and they worked out the plan in detail, and we had very, very effective leadership from the president and from the White House, and they guided the tax law through. Raising taxes in some places, lowering taxes in the other, so it was revenue neutral. Whether you like the Tax Reform Act of 1986 or not, it's what we have. But it took 2 years with a very popular president who clearly knew what he wanted. I don't know if you're aware, but President Trump has indicated he likes the Senate bill. Frankly, I looked at the Senate bill.
He also indicated he liked the House bill.
But he said we'll get a better one from the Senate.
Yeah, we'll get a better one from the Senate. I'm not sure he saw what they've done before they let it out, though.
The difficulty is, there was a Democrat, and I didn't catch his name, who was on the radio being interviewed about this. He was actually it was taped from one of the Sunday shows last week or sometime. I don't know. Anyway, he said something that struck me as being very accurate. The way these bills are written right now, these proposals are written right now, in my opinion, it's a lose-lose for Republicans.
I agree with that.
If either one of these or some combination of the two of these somehow gets pushed into existence as law, we individual human beings out here will not see a significant difference in our taxes, except you may not be able to itemize some things you itemized before. You may lose some tax deductions and get a slightly lower tax rate. But the thing is, it's just going to be A, different, and B, you'll pay about as much as you paid before. The big differential still comes down, no matter how you look at these two proposals, to two big issues. Number one, the federal debt goes to, depending on how you count it, somewhere between 100% and 120% of gross domestic product 10 years from now. from the 77 to 85 that we've got it today, depending on how you count it. Secondly, corporate taxes are cut to 20%. And that's really it in a nutshell. The middle class tax cut, if it comes through, will be extremely minor. Now, if they get political, if they look at the fact that they just lost a couple of governorships and the Republicans decide to get political, they may tax the corporations a bunch more, which won't help the economy a bit, and lower individual taxes more, so that you will notice that you pay less in the way of taxes. But that doesn't eliminate what I, and this is Jeff speaking, for myself, Jake can chime in if he wants to.
Chime.
To raise an already, the federal debt is about as high as a percentage of GDP as we need to get it. We need to be probably pulling it down a little bit, which, by the way, means raising taxes, because you say, well, cut spending. Well, you can't. And I can discuss that with you at great length, because every place that you might want to cut spending enough to make a difference, you're going to say, no, don't cut there. That's defense, Medicare, or Social Security. You got your choice. But if we raise taxes a little bit, and we consistently, at this point, work towards a balanced budget and allow the economy to grow on that balanced budget, in other words, that's not paying down the debt. It's not raising the taxes to have a surplus. But it's moving in these good times when we have nearly full employment, when we have a very healthy economy, when everything is going well, moving back to a pay-as-you-go system and letting the growth in the economy then liquidate the debt over time. That's a very relatively painless way to get us ready for whatever the next crisis is. That makes sense to me. But to cut taxes so we virtually guarantee an overwhelming debt 10 years in the future, to the point that both bills, both proposals, terminate in 10 years because they recognize the debt will be so high at that point that they have to, the right rule says they cannot make a change in the tax law or any bill that will raise the deficit for more than 10 years. Raise it above where it is today.
Right.
In other words, the
basically what it's saying is you can't lock in any future Congress to more than 10 years without going through the full Senate and House complete lawmaking process.
Which takes a 60% majority.
That's the supermajority. You got to have that.
And to, very frankly, I don't get it. Maybe somebody can explain to me why the same people who were deficit hawks last year,
And the year before that, and the decade before that,
are today not only deficit dubs, their deficit, the deficit hawk has changed meaning. It means they are for raising the federal debt. In their documents, acknowledging that 10 years from now, it will reach the point where it becomes a crisis, but we're going to set up a crisis 10 years in the future in order to get a bill passed.
Yeah, and there's an important piece here. Those of you that have listened to us for lots of years know that back in the early 2000s, there was another tax cut that was on the table. It was the Bush tax cut. And it was also going to get rid of the estate tax. And it did for a year, and then it came back because it followed the same rules. It had the 10-year deal tagged onto it. So all of the capital gains rates and the estate tax going away disappeared. We were all for that tax cut.
Because we were in a recession.
We were in a recession, and we had a surplus. The government had a surplus. It was getting more money in revenue than it was spending. This started in the late 90s and came in through 2000. Some of that was because of the Resolution Trust Corporation being profitable. All of the foreclosed on and bad properties that the savings and loan crisis drew up in the early 90s were being sold by the government through the Resolution Trust Corporation for massive profits right there. A lot of the credit goes to Bill Clinton when the reality is the credit should have gone to George H.W. Bush and Ronald Reagan for setting up the Resolution Trust Corporation, which brought a lot of revenue into the government. So we had more taxes than we were spending. And the government tends to either spend it all or find another way to spend it all. So at that point, they said, let's cut taxes. We've got more coming in. We're still paying off the debt faster than we're making the debt. This is great. So let's lower taxes. And both of us said, absolutely, this is the great time to do it. We're in a recession. This was after the crash of 2000 as far as the market goes, but we were in a minor recession there. We're in contraction mode in the country. We lowered taxes. Revenue went up because, one, we were in a recession. More people went to business because of the lower taxes. But then we got into two wars. We were attacked majorly. The 9/11 happened. We invaded Afghanistan. We didn't change the budget there. We didn't raise the taxes back to what they were. We suddenly started spending a lot of money, which meant we started going to debt, which people, you know, countries do that in wartime. It's a good use of debt. If you look back at what happened to the debt in World War I and World War II, we borrowed a lot of money. That's part of the reason why we won.
If you go back and look at history and tax cuts, you'll discover that Art Laffer was correct in his life. But the Kennedy administration pushed through a democratically controlled Congress, Democratic Party controlled it, a cut from a 90% tax rate, which was designed to help pay off the debt of World War II, to a 50% tax rate, and saw an increase in revenue to the government. And everybody said, wow, cut taxes, we get an increase in revenue. The next time there was an attempt to lower tax rates to increase revenue was under Ronald Reagan. And what we saw under Ronald Reagan was we lowered tax rates with the concept of trickle-down came from there and the supply-side economics. And it was the theory, and it was a good theory based on the data they had, was that if we lower tax rates, we will see an increase in revenue, and we did for 1 year.
And then it dropped.
And then it dropped, and then the deficit started soaring. So in 1986, Ronald Reagan sat down with members of Congress and worked out what is the base of the current law that we have today. It's been amended to the point where you don't even recognize it anymore. And a tax law with the intent, and one of his prime intentions was when he realized that General Electric, for the previous several years, and he used to work for General Electric, Ronald Reagan was infuriated when he realized they paid no federal income tax because the tax law was set up with so many deductions and credits for corporations that they paid no income tax at all. And he created a much simplified tax code that raised capital gains rates and did a bunch of other stuff of that nature, and actually stabilize the revenue, actually raise the revenue to the government a little bit. And we have been running on that system ever since. Now, it has been so modified and jiggered with and added to and hung from that it is unrecognizably complex today. It started as a simple flat tax. It's a very, very complex system today. But the history of
flat tax with four brackets.
Well, it actually started with two. It was 15 and 28, period.
Oh, that's right.
And capital gains was 28. I mean, it's 15 and 28. That's it.
It'd be nice to go back to that.
Well, if we go back to it, except we didn't.
That's what.
Raising capital gains rates to 28%.
That would be painful.
Was one of the things that's credited with the 1986.
Crash.
1987
crash.
Yeah, because it took effect on January 1st, 1987. But that probably the capital gains were probably a little too high. They overreacted and overtaxed the corporations. Well, now the corporations are overtaxed, so we need to. There is a very powerful argument for simplification. There is a powerful argument for revenue neutral. Let me explain why the revenue neutral argument I think has some validity. If we go revenue neutral and we get smarter with our tax code, and we simplify the tax code, and we get a good growth in the economy, it just continues to grow like it's been growing, we will eventually start to pay down our federal debt. We're not at the point where we're beyond the point of no return at this time. If we cut taxes at this point, the very, very, very high probability is, because something will happen in the next 10 years. Something unexpected and expensive will happen. I can't guarantee it, but I can tell you there's probably a 99.9% probability. Something that we're not planning on right now will happen internationally or physically or weather-wise or an earthquake or something, and we'll spend a lot more money than we're planning on at some point. If we cut taxes now, the most high probability is simple. It'll have the same effect as the Bush tax cuts. It will run the deficit up dramatically. And we're...
And that's accepted when people say that they're in the resolution that was... This is the written word of both the House and the Senate for the budget resolution. They have allowed for, with the new taxes, $1.5 trillion of new debt. This isn't
additional to the debt we were going to run
right
up anyway.
New debt on top of what we're already doing.
Right.
This is extra expense based on this. This is what they've already written down and already voted for. This isn't conspiracy theory stuff. This is in the resolution.
And these are some of the same people who threatened to, and by the way, only got a temporary extension. In December, we get the debt ceiling again. And if they don't want to raise the, this is the funny thing, if the same Republicans who say, let's cut taxes and raise the deficit, don't want to raise the debt ceiling, and I suspect we're going to see that coming, whoa, have we got hypocrisy.
Right, because if you know you're not raising taxes, you're lowering them. You're not cutting spending, you're adding to it. And you don't want to do a raise to the debt ceiling, that's just saying, I'm going to eat your cake and I'm not going to pay for it. That's not very cool. That's called nationalization of property. But this is to alleviate all the people that say, I want my taxes cut, that just feels too high. Statistically speaking, for the last 3 years, we have been each year at a record, both counted as number of dollars coming in and in a percentage of GDP, amount of tax revenue from personal income tax. We're paying more as a percentage of GDP, more in dollar numbers, both, than we ever have from personal income tax.
Including when it was 90% tax rate.
Including. You know, I've got this chart.
I built it up yesterday.
Looking back when it was a 90% tax rate, we were about a 7.5% of GDP from personal income taxes. Mm-hmm. We're now right at the 10% level.
Okay, 10% is probably as high as we need to go.
Yeah, and if we're talking about raising taxes at this point, we got to figure out another way of doing this. Well, basically, we should cut spending, and that's the big, big deal that we're not talking about.
I've looked at the numbers, and I've looked at the economy, and this my conclusion is we don't need to raise taxes, but we certainly don't need to lower them. And the reason I say this 10% level, I think following World War II, does yours go back to the 1940s?
It goes back to 1929.
Okay. We have run up a really, really, really big debt, and we have a slow-growing economy.
What happened after World War II, by the way? We had this huge spike in debt. Then we ran government surpluses for over a decade to pay it back. Mm. After World War I, we grew this huge debt in World War I. We ran a surplus all the way through into the Depression. We were running a surplus.
Did not have Medicare. We did not have Social Security.
Correct.
Did not have a global military ready to respond anywhere.
Absolutely correct. So each of those things, we have three major expenses that we didn't have at those other big periods of debt in our nation when we paid it back. So we have to say, which of those three or all of them, how much? What are we going to cut?
And very frankly, if we're going to continue to maintain peace so we can do commerce around the globe, and we're the biggest commerce doer.
Right. Really, you can't cut military.
We cannot afford to cut the military, because we cut the military, it leads to war. That's not good. The Navy has recently proven that they have more mission than they have money to cover it. The Army is complaining, you know, the M1 tank seems like a new tank to me, but the M1 tank has been around for 35 years. and some of those tanks are running around out there 35 years old, and you try driving a 35-year-old vehicle,
you're going to understand the problem.
The expense of continuing to drive that vehicle is excessive. So we have a problem, and the problem is we want to have more than we're willing to pay for. And I personally, this is just theory on my part, maybe hypothesis on my part. In my experience in studying economies around the world, if we go with a 10% personal income tax, basically we take 10% of our personal, 10% of the GDP is personal
right.
income tax.
Which is a different number from the bracket. So you just have to look at all the money made in profits, and 10% of that is paid in personal income
right.
tax to the government.
And when you look at the all the other things that are going on, that we pay taxes, because we wind up paying a pretty good sized chunk of money to the state, whether you're in an income tax state or a sales tax state, you wind up paying about 10% in income and property taxes in Texas, probably. So there's 20%. That's cool. And
And then there's business taxes and the other taxes. And,
well, the corporation taxes.
Which is about 2% of GDP.
The issue is that our corporate taxes need to be lowered to make corporations, because we'll make money. The United States will make money. I really think there would be a tax advantage to lowering corporate taxes. They're too high, and so we're running the money-producing things that creates taxes overseas. And if that means adding just a little bit to the taxes of the upper income people in the United States, and by the way, it can be done by adding some money, by adding to the taxes of upper income people. My experience in looking at history is they're not going to stop making their billions of dollars because their taxes went up 1% or 2%. Nor are they going to go out and make an extra couple of billion dollars and hire a bunch of people because the taxes go down 1% or 2%. That would make sense. Would it be popular among the political contributors? No. Would you get a tax break and therefore vote for the Republicans who control the House and the Senate if we said, no, it's far more fiscally responsible to continue the taxes at the rates they're at and for the average person and gradually pay down our debt? You probably wouldn't be too excited, and you might not vote him back into office.
Right.
And that's where we are. There's a responsible route, and there's a politically expedient route, and I'm frankly disappointed in the Speaker of the House. I thought he would do better, because when he was chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee,
he talked about cutting.
He talked about the need to pay down the debt. He talked about the need, and the theory, the stuff I'm telling you is stuff that came out of what Representative Ryan, when he was chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. We can do this in a relatively painless fashion, but we need to do it because the crisis will come in the future. Matter of fact, we have some guaranteed crisis about 2030, 2034. We have a guaranteed fiscal crisis in the United States.
Yeah. So it's guaranteed.
Cutting taxes at this point and raising spending is a horrible idea.
I can give you a great deal of assurance that it's going to be a different Congress in 2030 or 2034 than the Congress that we have today in 2017 and 2018.
Congress people will be retired and they won't have to worry about it. They'll be on their pensions and their pensions are guaranteed.
Right. Except that so are Social Security and Medicare, and that's part of the crisis that's coming.
Actually, Social Security and Medicare are not guaranteed.
They're guaranteed except for a act of Congress, just like the congressional pension is guaranteed except for by an act of Congress. It's the same act of Congress. They could change it. I mean, the guarantee is not based in a constitutional act of any kind. It's just a bill. And we've got some commercials that we need to play. If you would like to join in our inanity and talking about the silliness that is tax law, I realize it's the most exciting conversation.
That clock is very wrong.
Way wrong. That's why I keep pointing at my wrist and it's like pointing here. We've got to play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side. If you'd like to join us, it's 254-773-1400. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
And hot
right now?
Today.
Probably.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure on today, November 11th, 2017. And according to me, it's 11:56:30, so we only have about 3.5 minutes left. in our two-hour program today on 11-11.
But if you would like to talk to us off the air, this is something... We don't get paid for doing the radio program, by the way. We don't pay to do the radio program. We pay for advertising on this station, but we do this because we think it's important to educate the majority of people as soon as possible on how to invest and what does it mean when people are talking about the market or big things that are happening in the world and how does that affect us financially. But we do actually do something for a living, which is giving advice to people that really need our advice. We charge for it, but it's all talked about way in advance. In that process, we talk about how to invest. We talk about and we do the management on the investing in a lot of cases. If you'd like to contact us, we have voicemail waiting during the weekend and real live people, no phone tree during the week locally at
254-947-1111.
You can reach that same voicemail on the weekend and real live wonderful people during the week at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage. We encourage it. Thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. There are newsletters that we spend a lot of time researching every week. Goes out Friday, and so it's available most days on Saturday. We've got podcasts of this program going back quite a few years. If you wonder what predictions we were making a few years ago, did we predict or not predict, you can go back and listen. Our predictions are really based on what's going on in reality, and so we try not to go out on limbs too much.
Let me make another comment, one other piece of news. The Wall Street Journal surveyed economists around the country who have been consistent in their forecasts and correct, and more or less correct. And they say there's a 26% chance that we'll pull out of NAFTA.
Yeah.
Now that's a 1 in 4 chance. But they also said if we pull out of NAFTA, the United States economy will grow at a slower rate than if we don't pull out of NAFTA, and B, there's a fair chance.
That's an easy calculation.
That pulling out of NAFTA would put us into a recession. And talking about something that would cause our revenue to drop below projections, pulling out of NAFTA or a NAFTA. Or the recession caused by that would be a really good way to see the deficit spiral out of control if we have this tax proposal pass.
Right. So we're down to the last 20 seconds or so. If you, again, would like to contact us off the air, voicemail 254-947-1111, toll free 1-800-914-7526. We appreciate you listening.
Presuming that anybody did.
And if you did, and if you are a veteran, please accept our sincere gratitude for your service. We need it on every day.
Fox News radio station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.